Welcome. Thank you for joining me. I'm Sue Colvin, and this is an archive issue of the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, or support the pod on Patreon. If you are interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Look for the links in the show description, as well as links for the Downy Salmon Federation, its mission, merch, and to sign up for their newsletter. Joining me in this episode are former ichthyology students of mine, Levi Badgen and Matt Hodgkins. We recorded this episode in March 2020. Shortly thereafter, our campus and much of the country shut down due to COVID. Weeks later, I relocated to Arkansas, and the episode got shelved. I more recently dusted it off. It's a bit rough in places, but our guest, Zach Scheller, hatchery manager of the Peter Gray Parr Project, is recording at the East Machias Conservation Hatchery in East Machias, Maine, which is about a 40-minute drive to the easternmost point in the U.S. The Downy Salmon Federation's mission is to conserve wild Atlantic salmon, other sea-run fish in their habitats, restore a viable recreational salmon fishery, and protect other important river, scenic, recreational, and ecological resources in eastern Maine. The hatchery specifically uses a method founded on the principles of noted Scottish biologist Peter Gray. These methods emphasize raising fish to behave and look like wild fish. Many of us may be more familiar with hatchery salmon reared for a sport fishery, which are arguably less fit and less beautifully marked than their wild counterparts. In recent years, though, conservation hatcheries have attempted to improve the fitness of hatchery-reared fish, and the Downy's Conservation Hatchery has found a unique and successful method to restore a genetically unique stock of Atlantic salmon to their home range. Enjoy the show! So welcome to another episode of the Fisheries Podcast. This is your co-host, Sue Colvin, and today we're going to talk about conservation hatcheries. And I have special guests with me today, current and former members of the Unity College Ichthyology class, and we're going to be asking questions that are submitted by the class today of our guest, Zach Scheller. And Zach works with the Downy Salmon Federation as part of the Peter Gray Parr Project. He's a hatchery manager there and a fisheries biologist. And so he's joining us today. But I have two current students. Matt Hodgkins is a wildlife and fisheries management major here with us at Unity College in Unity, Maine, as well as Levi Badgent, wildlife and fisheries management major. And welcome. Thank you for joining me. I'm Sue Colvin, and this is an archive issue of the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, or support the pod on Patreon. If you are interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Look for the links in the show description, as well as links for the Downy Salmon Federation, its mission, merch, and to sign up for their newsletter. Joining me in this episode are former ichthyology students of mine, Levi Badgen and Matt Hodgkins. We recorded this episode in March 2020. Shortly thereafter, our campus and much of the country shut down due to COVID. Weeks later, I relocated to Arkansas, and the episode got shelved. I more recently dusted it off. It's a bit rough in places, but our guest, Zach Scheller, hatchery manager of the Peter Gray Parr Project, is recording at the East Machias Conservation Hatchery in East Machias, Maine, which is about a 40-minute drive to the easternmost point in the U.S. The Downy Salmon Federation's mission is to conserve wild Atlantic salmon, other sea-run fish in their habitats, restore a viable recreational salmon fishery, and protect other important river, scenic, recreational, and ecological resources in eastern Maine. The hatchery specifically uses a method founded on the principles of noted Scottish biologist Peter Gray. These methods emphasize raising fish to behave and look like wild fish. Many of us may be more familiar with hatchery salmon reared for a sport fishery, which are arguably less fit and less beautifully marked than their wild counterparts. In recent years, though, conservation hatcheries have attempted to improve the fitness of hatchery-reared fish, and the Down East Conservation Hatchery has found a unique and successful method to restore a genetically unique stock of Atlantic salmon to their home range. Enjoy the show. And Levi is an emerging fisheries professional. He worked last summer for the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association in Alaska and is looking forward to this summer on new fisheries adventures. And so Levi and Matt are joining us today to talk to Zach and ask him questions about the Peter Gray hatchery that were submitted by our ichthyology class. And so Levi, do you want to kick us off and ask Zach your first question?
Yeah, sure. So Zach, down with the Down East and Peter Gray, what is the conservation hatchery and how is it different from hatcheries that produce game fish?
Thank you for having me. And I would say that the conservation hatchery, biggest difference I would think is, you know, we grow native fish to the state, and not only native fish, but in our case, we're growing endangered fish, the Atlantic salmon. So I would say a conservation hatchery is just, the focus is more about restoring the ecosystem around that fish and restoring that fish to population we haven't seen for a while due to various impacts like dams and pollution, overfishing, things like that. Other hatcheries, you know, their goal is more production of numbers and putting fish out, you know, in the case of state-run hatcheries, often they're providing a game fish like a brook trout or for anglers and opportunities for them. Not that brook trout and landlocked salmon are native to Maine, but those are some of the differences between the two. Or if you look out west, those salmon are native also, but they still have a bunch of wild fish, but to supplement the commercial fishery and angling opportunities out there, they produce a lot of salmon for the West Coast. With the Peter Gray PAR project, we are using naturalized techniques in a hatchery to try to grow fish that act more like wild fish and put them out in the river and let them do their thing. And one of the things that the unique parts of that structure is stocking PAR out, which would be fish that have grown through their first summer and into the fall, and instead of stocking fry right away in May. So this creates a fish that's a little bit bigger, better able to evade predators, better able to find food, better able to swim to cold water in summertime, things like that.
All right, so how is Peter Gray hatchery unique amongst other hatcheries?
Yeah, so I mentioned the PAR, that's step one. The second step would be we use unfiltered. So that means the fish in our hatchery experience pH changes that happen in the river, temperature changes that happen in the river, sediment. You know, if we have a big storm, then the tanks in our hatchery become murky just like the river does. And what this does is create a fish that has immunities built up to the bacteria in the water, has experienced those fluctuations in pH. So whenever we stock them out into that same river water, it's not quite a shock to their system. They already know that. They already grew up in that. Our hatchery, you want to think of it like an extension of the river. We pump water in, it cycles through our tanks and then heads right back out into the river. And, you know, we're not stripping everything out of it, which is why we get some bacteria and things like that through. But the idea is we're making a hardier fish. Peter Gray, who these methods are mimic after, he helped restore the river Tyne with these methods. And he would say we're creating little athletes because we need fish that are athletic enough to live in the river, but also, so on top of using the river water and growing PAR, we use black tanks, which keep the fish a dark natural color. If you raise salmon in a light blue tank, they get pretty pale and light blue. And then if you stock a pale fish into a dark river, they pretty much have a neon sign that says, come eat me. Our fish, however, are color just like a wild fish, which includes the PAR marks, which provides their camouflage. When our fish hatch from egg to alpen, instead of keeping them in egg trays, we move them into what we call substrate incubation boxes. And those are boxes filled with gravel and plastic media. And their goal is to mimic salmon red inside our hatchery. So the alvin have plenty of space to go find somewhere to develop. And then just like in the river, when they're ready to feed and the river's ready, they swim up and out of the gravel. They'll swim up and out of our boxes and into our big tanks. And that's how we know they're ready. If you were to stock fry, it would let you know when they're ready to stock. Or in our case, let us know when they're ready to start feeding. The two last things that kind of set us apart is as the fish increase in size through the summer, we'll increase the flow and velocity of the water in the tanks to try to, you know, pretty much give the fish a treadmill to run on to create a stronger fish. And then when we stock our fish, we put out higher densities than were typically used down east, well, actually in the state of Maine. And idea being saturate the river with salmon and let Mother Nature sort it out from there.
That is a unique strategy indeed. Do you want to give us a quick introduction to the endangered Atlantic salmon and their importance to the region?
Sure. So, you know, Atlantic salmon culturally are very important. You know, the natives in different parts of North America, you know, and also over in Europe, been catching salmon to sustain themselves for eons. And, you know, everything tied to that, like where they lived, how they moved, where they moved, was dictated by fish runs, including salmon runs. You know, we've gone away from that a little bit because we have grocery stores where things come in nice little plastic and styrofoam packages.
Indeed.
But before that, you know, we had to go to where the resources were or know what resources were available at different times of the year. So, you know, as the salmon, so now in Maine, you can't fish for salmon anymore. Unfortunately, that's good in that we're not impacting the fish with angling, but it's bad in that you're losing that cultural part where, you know, grandmothers and fathers and mothers and grandfathers took, you know, children out fishing for salmon. That became what they did. And then the people catching those salmon then develop an appreciation and a knowledge of those fish, and not only the fish, but also the rivers. So whenever you lose that, you lose people recognizing that resource or that important part of the ecosystem is still here, just in smaller numbers. They're, and part of the reason people through our facility to help with fin clipping and things like that is kids can handle endangered Atlantic salmon, see what a salmon looks like. And perhaps next time they're driving over the river on a bridge or out fishing for something else, they can remember that fish and that it's there and that it's important to take care of.
Social dynamics are definitely very important whenever it comes to managing fisheries. I think Matt had a question here.
Yeah. So what's the importance of limiting the growth rate in a hatchery?
Well, we don't, to clarify that point, we don't really limit the growth in our hatchery. What our hatchery does is the river limits the growth of the salmon in our hatchery versus a hatchery that might stay a more consistent temperature through the summer. You know, a river down east can get up to 25 degrees Celsius in the middle of summer. Whenever it's that warm, salmon don't feed as aggressively as like when it's 18 or 19 degrees Celsius. You can imagine if for that month or two, if you had a fish in the power band of feeding 18, 19 degrees Celsius, they would get bigger than a fish whose feeding metabolism slows during that time because it's warmer. So the key to that is whenever we stock our fish out, they are essentially the size of the fish in the river. So we're not making fish that are abnormally larger. And where that also comes into play is if you stock a par that's larger, it has a higher likelihood of leaving the very next spring as a smolt. Now, smolt leaving the river is our goal, but what we're looking for is smolt leaving after a year or two in the river, because what we find is that those smolt then survive better in the ocean for 2 years to come back and spawn in our rivers. So by creating a naturally sized smolt or a naturally sized par, they function more like a wild par in the river and stay for longer before they leave to the ocean as a smolt. You know, because in the wild, at least in our down east rivers, we don't have 1 year old smolt. But when you stock a hatchery fish, you do get 1 year old smolts, which isn't the way the wild fish do it. So our goal by having more naturally sized fish is to reduce the amount of smolt that leave as those early migrators and have the fish to stay longer in the river. Because the theory is the longer they live in the river, the better they get at evading predators and finding food and have surviving in the ocean.
Wow. Awesome.
Right. Do you mind? Let's talk some genetics and return some here. Does Downey's transplant genetics from one run to another?
No, currently the state of Maine does genetics. So the Down East region actually has 5 rivers that have unique genetic strains of fish to each river. So at our Peter Gray hatchery, we grow East Machias river-specific genetic strain salmon.
Nice. You know,
Craigbrook National Fish Hatchery, they maintain the broodstock lines for the different rivers. So they have a room of sheepskin, a room of Machias, the room of Penobscot, and they maintain those lines. And down east, you know, the Machias fish go into Machias, the East Machias go into East Machias. They do take some Penobscot fish and stock them in like the Kennebec, for instance, to try to start a line there, but there isn't a specific river line still in the Kennebec. But down east we do have that. Which is a good thing because each of those fish are a little different. For instance, not only genetically are they different, but their phenotype can also change a bit. East Machias is a flatter watershed with more lakes and deadwaters, and the salmon tend to be a bit more broad and stocky, whereas the Machias is less lake type setup, and there is also Bad Little Falls right in Machias, which is a pretty tall waterfall. So those fish tend to be a bit more sleek, with a little bit thinner, body, but a bigger tail to help them get over the waterfalls. That's not every fish, and sometimes it can be very minute, but as a general broad stroke, those are the sort of things you can see. And obviously those genetic traits is what has developed over thousands of years.
Nice. Yes?
Before we go on, can we have Zach define down east just for those listeners that are outside of New England?
Okay.
Yeah, so down east Maine, I think it actually got its name from when people would sail. The way the winds blew, they actually went down to go east. So that's where down east came from. But we're pretty much talking about the Union River, which empties out in Ellsworth Bar Harbor area, up to the Canadian border, the St. Croix. But the 5 salmon rivers in down east Maine, or the 5 rivers with genetic strains, would be the Narragansett, the Pleasant, the Machias, East Machias, and the Denny's River, going south to north.
Nice.
Thanks for that clarification. So Levi, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, it's still talking about genetics and returns. Possibly, how do these fry know which river to return to, especially if there is genetic crossover? But you said that you guys don't, so you don't have to worry about that.
Right. So when you stock salmon, they imprint to the area you stock them. And so that can be done. So even if you are growing fish on a different water source, when you go and stock them in a certain river, they'll imprint to that area and to that river. And there's also a lot of thousands of years of instinct built into this too, but, you know, is there a chemical, quote unquote, or something like that, or a cue that lets the fish know where they're going to? Not exactly sure. There's a lot of different theories out there on this, but it is interesting. Not only do the salmon hone back to their natal river, they often hone back to specific areas of their river where they were stocked or where they were born. You know, if they were born in a tributary to the East Machias, like Northern, that's often where they'll try to get back to when they come back. Based on studies that have been done in other places, we haven't done any tracking studies to confirm that, but it's pretty well known that salmon do that across the board. And so the benefit, not only are we stocking our fish into the river, we are also raising them in this river. So they're experiencing whatever that chemical signature of the East Machias is their entire life.
Exactly.
The aid in them honing back to this river.
Nice. Thanks.
Yep.
Now, in the stock populations to natural populations, even though there's not really much natural populations left, have you seen a difference in survivability with your stock populations?
Right. So, since starting the PARP project, our first big stocking was basically back in 2012. And so we're entering our, well, what is that, ninth year, I guess, this year. We've been collecting data all along. We do electrofishing with Maine Department of Marine Resources out of the Jonesboro office. We also typically do smolt trapping in partnership with NOAA and that same Jonesboro office, Maine DMR. And then we do red counts, for the adult returns. And what we've seen, now we only have 1 year of comparison for the smolt trapping as to what the river was producing with unfed fry stocking before we started stocking PAR. But we've essentially quadrupled the number of smolts heading to the ocean from that year. Now, was it a high year, an average year? Based on the other rivers in the state, it was probably an average year as far as that first year with unfed fry stocking that we're comparing to. We also have juvenile densities of salmon in the river that are the highest we've seen since the 1970s. The smolt numbers obviously have quadrupled, which never smolt trapped this river before this project. So that's kind of baseline data there. And then, last year we counted 60 reds from fish returning from our project to the East Machias River. And that's the most reds we've seen in this river for four decades. And
that's crazy.
Well above the average, which is, it pretty much been around single digit 15 for a number of years. So that's a pretty nice jump. And, nothing compared to, Canada where they have 15,000 or other places, but for down East Maine, that's, and for Maine in general, that's pretty huge to see that. So hopefully that's something that continues. So what we see is that our fish, we lose a lot in the river. We do. The number that make it to smolt is less than 1%. But even before things were bad for salmon from man-made issues, salmon still laid 5,000 to 10,000 eggs per female. The only reason animals lay, the whole life cycle is slated to lose a certain number in each life stage. A certain number of eggs don't get fertilized, a certain number of those don't make it to alvin, and so on and so forth. But what we, from that number of smolts leaving and the number of reds we were counting, is that our smolt to adult return rate is around 2%, which still doesn't sound like a lot. But if you compare that to, say, the smolt stocked fish on the Penobscot, there were over 1,000 fish that came back last year in 2019. But based on the number of smolts that leave that system, it's 4% smolt to adult return rate. So 2% is pretty large compared to 0.14.
Indeed, especially in high numbers like that.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy to just look at too.
Right. Now the issue is you need to, they're sending out 650,000 smolt for this method, the Peter Gray method, to produce that number of smolt. You would need to stock a very large amount of PAR, but it could be done. It's just a matter of changing. It's just a matter of changing what's currently, which is easier said than done.
Indeed. What's the strategy of your guys' data collection whenever it comes to the smolt running out and then their return rates for your stock populations?
Strategy being, why do we choose to...
No, like how you collect the data for that to see how many actually came back of your guys' stock populations.
I got you. So we mark every single fish that leaves our hatchery. That's the fin clipping that's been mentioned.
Yep.
Bunch of volunteers, hundreds every year come in and we clip however many fish we have. And so for instance, last year we stocked out, I think 220,000 par. So those fish are clipped. So when we are electrofishing we catch a fish, we know if it came from the Peter Gray hatchery. And when we're smolt trapping, if we catch a fish that has an A clip, we know that it came from our hatchery. So from that, we can determine of the fish that we capture in our rotary screw traps, which are big cones as the river and catch a percentage of the fish leaving the river. We can determine what percentage is naturally reared and what percentage is semi-naturally reared our par. And pretty much for the last number of years, you know, it's 98%, 99% of the smolt run is our A-clip fish from the Peter Gray hatchery. And honestly, we're the only ones that put fish into the river. So even though would have come from natural spawning from the PAR project, or we, up until this year, we were putting out a small number of fry each year, small tribs, just as a backup. We're changing that this year because we got the 60 reds. We're going to go out and see how productive they were. And hopefully we do have to buffer those reds because there's a bunch of yoy that were produced from those reds. That's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
So because we've been long enough, and because when we go out on red count and we know that salmon for the most part hone to their river of origin, we're pretty much just counting every red we count, you know, we're attributing that to the PAR project because that's realistically where it's coming from. You know, and a red, for those that don't know, is the nest that a female salmon makes in the gravel of a river. And that's where she will lay her eggs. So when you're canoeing down or walking down a stream, the rocks that get turned over, you can see the pit and the different colors of the rocks. And that's how you can pick out a red.
Thanks for that, Zach. Matt, did you have a follow-up question that was pertinent to that?
Yeah, so is the current population sampling, like rotary screw traps, the most ideal form of sampling, or are there other traps or methods you have taught, that you have thought about?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in the world of science and the world of field assessment, you know, there's always many different ways to get to certain answers. So you need to kind of ask yourself a few questions. What is it we're trying to answer? But then perhaps the more important question is, what resources do we currently have that we can use? And also, what types of sampling are being done in other parts of the state that you can compare to? So rotary screw trap assessment's been happening on the Narragansett River for over a decade, almost two decades. So whenever we use those, and in Southern Maine, they've used them on the Sheepskit and other places here and there. So whenever we use a rotary screw trap assessment on the East Machias, A, we had the, well, NOAA had the traps to use and we borrowed them. And B, we're able to then compare those numbers against those other populations. It's not apples to apples because they're different rivers, but and strategies, but it can help us tease apart, you know, how successful one strategy is versus another. So, you know, as far as adult capture or smolt capture, you can put the river. The problem with weirs in a river, they function like a dam. Mm-hmm. So we're putting these fish out, these hatchery fish that were growing as wild as possible, to go into the river and act like a wild fish, not to mention the wild fish we have in the river. Do we really want to put a for them to have to go through to either right. go up to spawn or to leave to the ocean? You know, our rotary screw traps, we catch about 20% of the population. So we're only really impacting that 20%. Now it's for a good cause, because it's why I can tell you we've quadrupled the number of smolts since the start of the PAR project. But there is also fish to do that, extra stress and things like that.
Follow up for that question too. How long has the PAR project been going on for?
Since 2012. Okay. So this is we had a small pilot year in 2011, but essentially 2012 in full force, you know, increasing the number of eggs and fish we stocked as we go. But our egg source is Craigberg National Fish Hatchery. So, you know, the number of eggs we receive each year is dictated by, you know, the number of broodstock that they've spawned, how good the IEP rate of those fish are, what the fecundity of the females were, which is how many eggs the females had in them. So there's other variables at play as far as how many eggs we start with each year.
Levi, did you have some follow-up questions? I thought of a couple that I had just over the past few minutes. But what did you have to follow up with that, Levi?
I have many, many things that I could ask you about the dam. So the traps. And the one that I'm more interested in is you said that you guys are sampling at a 20% of the population running through. Are you getting that off of how large the trap is with the water flow coming downstream in the rivers?
That's a good question. So we use a mark recapture study on the smolt traps.
Yes.
The first day we catch a salmon, we have a mark of the day. It might be an upper caudal, lower caudal punch. And then we'll release the fish we catch, the salmon that we catch that day, about a kilometer upriver. And the percent of those recaptures that we get is essentially the 20%, which gives us the amount of fish we're... So from that data, we can assume that we're missing 80%. And then all flow of the river, revolutions of the traps, what waves of mercury capture those fish came through, go into a formula, and that determines the population estimate for that year. So there's a lot of variables that play into that, but mark recapture, the percent of fish we recapture, is essentially our trap efficiency.
Awesome. Thank you. Yep. Sue, did you have some questions too?
Yeah. I wanted to, since we're kind of getting a little bit closer to the end of our time together today, I wanted to ask you, Zach, has the Downy Salmon Federation thought of expanding their operation? And we may not have mentioned, but you're a nonprofit, which is unusual in the hatchery world. And you serve this particular population, but have you thought of expanding to other main rivers?
Yeah, we talk about it every day.
So you do?
That's a permitting and a funding question. The beautiful thing is, since we started the PAR project, with the data we've collected with MAR and other partners, we've proven that our Peter Gray PAR put into B and C width class streams, which would be B width class is 6 to 12 meters wide, and C width class would be like your main stem down East River, you know, 12 to 18 meters wide. Our fish into those habitats in the East Machias out all other stocking strategies that have been used in the past, to include gravid adults, which would be adults they put in the spawn, unfed fry, fed fry, things like that. So what that is that means, theoretically, if we were to put Peter Gray style fish into another river, we would see the same thing. So right now, we stock a unit of habitat, 100 square meters. We can almost produce one smolt per unit of habitat that we stock with our PAR. So that means if we were to stock 3,000 units of habitat in, say, the Narragansett, then we just increase the smolt population of the Narragansett by 3,000, which, when you're talking about a population last year that was down around 600 or 700, that'd be substantial in the Narragansett, for instance. And so, yeah, we'd like to expand. We've talked about a lot of different things. We do have another hatchery on the Pleasant River in Columbia Falls, and we don't have capacity to grow PAR there. So obviously a plan could be expanding that, but we do grow fry there. We help. So in the winter, we help Maine DMR Jonesboro office eggplant, which is using a water pump to bore a hole in spawning shoals and put eyed eggs directly in the gravel. And then in the lower part of the river, we grow Peter Gray fry. So since we can't do par, do Peter Gray fry in that we use our incubation boxes to mimic the reds, and we also pump straight river water. So it's kind of a sliding scale of, you know, ideal would be a unique Peter Gray hatchery on each river, but if we can't with par, but if we can't quite get there, well, if we can use the Peter Gray method, maybe our fry we're making are better than fry that don't have the exposure to that river water or the incubation box. So those are kind of the ideas. See, like to expand, and yeah, we're a nonprofit, which is unique in the salmon world as far as having the permitting to be able to raise endangered fish. It's you know, it's a pretty important task, a pretty important role. It takes a lot of work to make it happen, but you know, it's good. We're making a difference. Sometimes it's just making people realize you're making a difference.
And your website for your organization is mainesalmonrivers.org. And there's actually like a donation tab on there, and they can also sign up for your newsletter, right?
Yeah. You can sign up for the newsletter. We send out email blasts, so you can always contact us with your email if you keep on board of what's going on with the Peter Gray Par Project or DSF as a whole. You can always donate. You know, it really is the sort of thing, even, you know, $5-$10 here and there, it all adds up to make a difference. We do have a membership that we've had for a long time. You know, people give every year, and then we have some larger donors, and then we also have the fortune of receiving for DSF and some parts of the PAR project grants and foundations, you know, applying for grants and things like that. So every little bit helps, you know, towards a good cause.
Are you guys still selling hats and t-shirts? I know those were really cool.
We do have hats, t-shirts, sweatshirts. Yep. All the things.
Represent. Levi and Matt, did you want to ask some questions, some follow-up questions before we wrap up today? Do you think overall, Zach, let's see, the estimation for potential recovery of Atlantic salmon is 60 years, right? At this point,
if you're referring to the recovery plan that came out, I think right. It was 75 years. You know, that's political. There's a lot of politics that go into play in the salmon restoration world.
For you know, sure.
State budgets. I don't want to get too much, but go ahead.
I guess why I brought that up is just kind of, shaking around in my mind, and I just wanted you to address whether or not you thought that what your project was involved in would help speed that up or help make that possible. I know that's kind of a big question putting you on the spot, but how reasonable do you think that estimate is with what you all have going on, and there's some other efforts in the region to help recover and restore Atlantic salmon?
I think if focus was given, I think that timeline could be shortened. You know, it's a difficult proposition in that every year is different. Some years we have drought. Some years we don't have drought. Some winters are rough. Some winters aren't rough. Sometimes ocean survival is poor. Sometimes it's a little bit better. So there's a lot at play. But you know, our project, the Peter Gray Par Project, if you can increase the number of smolts going to the ocean, and the percentage of those smolts returning as adults is 20 or 10 or even 5 times higher than the other strategies being used, and you're seeing densities of fish in the river that you haven't for decades, and you haven't since back in quote unquote good for salmon, if you replicated that on more rivers, which would only increase the number of smolts going to the Gulf of Maine, which would only increase their chances heading up Greenland, how does it not speed up the timeline and make things better? Would be my answer to that question.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And then another question that kind of reflects one that was submitted by a student in our class. What kind of correlates are you seeing with like good returns with other species or just other factors? Is there anything that you kind of notice when you're out there?
Yes, that's a good question. I do remember seeing some questions about, you know, talking of river herring and lamprey and things like that. You know, at DSF and in certain parts of the Atlantic salmon restoration world, people are really trying to think of this holistically. It's an ecosystem that the salmon are in. And when you're missing pieces and parts of that ecosystem, it impacts all the species within that web. So strong river herring run and a strong sea lamprey run and a strong, you know, eel population and all these things play in to not only, you know, increase the diversity in the river, but also all those fish coming from the ocean bring nutrients to the system. So, you know, a lot of river herring get eaten along spawn. A lot of them die after they spawn. A lot get eaten on their way out. Their juveniles get eaten the whole way. All these fish add to the ecosystem of the river, all the way down to primary productivity, which obviously is the base for most things. Things like sea lamprey, the adults, when they come back, they're not being parasitic on fish when they're coming back to spawn. And they're actually pretty great habitat engineers. They'll pick rocks up in their mouth and make mounds. So one of the problems we have down east and other places is the rivers are embedded. There's a lot of fines and sands that block in the rocks. So if you have more salmon digging pits and you have more lampreys making mounds and moving rocks around, they actually improve the habitat of the river spawning in as they're doing those tasks. So since we started the PAR project, is there a difference in those others? I really don't have that data. Fortunately, the East Machias has a strong river herring run, and we actually have all the, I think it's 11 or 12 sea run fish that are native to Maine still coming back to this river in some numbers or another. So that's all good, you know.
And I got a question that I guess could come off that too.
Yep.
This is going into like the restoration efforts. Do you think maybe we should be focusing our improvements on the headwaters and the water quality, or possibly dams and dam removal, even though that's a pretty big, you know, debatable topic?
Yes. I say that tongue in cheek. The answer is all the things, right?
Yeah.
Just like there wasn't one bullet that sent salmon down this path of endangered, there's really not one thing that can fix it all. It's all the things. And there are some dam removals that are very political and contentious and pretty high profile. I mean, look at the ones done on the Penobscot with the Penobscot River. Huge dam removals. We spearheaded a dam removal in East Machias where our facility is. The hatchery I'm sitting in is actually a former hydroelectric facility that is now repurposed to try to restore the river. The same with our facility on the Pleasant River. So some dams maybe can't come out, but you can work fish passage upstream and downstream to increase survivability, or maybe they can do more spill during the smolt run so less smolts get chewed up in turbines, things like that. And then the dams that are still around that aren't being used or aren't needed, let's get our act together and get them out of there, you know what I mean? And which will improve water quality and thermal refugia. You know, you can pull out culverts we pulled out multiple culverts like on Beaver Dam Stream that essentially acted as dams because they were too high in certain water levels, or the water would shoot through there so fast that fish couldn't get through. So all those habitat things, along with large wood additions to the streams, like up in the headwaters, which can cause scour pools and gravel formations behind them and create spawning habitat or create places for young eyer to hide, you know, all those things happening together can benefit salmon. So exactly. It's just a matter of trying to do all those things. You know, and a lot of times it's how do you increase the pie as far as funding? So more of those things can get done at the same time.
A pretty big concern I've seen is also the northern pike invading Maine, you know, and I've seen debate on we shouldn't remove the dams because it's just opening up more habitat for the pike, and they can do a pretty big damage on your smolt populations also, and it's just a big concern.
Yeah, it definitely is. Invasive species are a real thing, and the East Machias is full of largemouth and smallmouth bass, both of which are invasive species to Maine. Smallmouths have been around, though, since the 1800s when people put them here. And, you know, it's kind of frustrating. I stock a lot of fish, and they struggle to make it. And then someone can dump a bucket of something into a lake, cause all sorts of damage, you know. And then sometimes those fish become pretty popular sport fisheries. So then they're managed for as a sport fishery. And sometimes even to the detriment of the native fish that are in those places.
Yeah. Debatable topic.
Yeah. That one's would be one of those contentious ones we talked about earlier. So.
Yeah. That's great. I'm so glad you brought that up though, Levi. That's something that we talk about often at school, isn't it?
Indeed.
So
and I've seen firsthand.
To wrap up, gentlemen, and let's start with you, Zach, and then Matt, and then you, Levi. What are some words to live by for conservation or otherwise? Zach?
It's a good question. I would say I don't have a succinct phrase for you, but as far as you know, I struggle sometimes because I get impatient and I want to see things happen now. And there's a lot of things it's like, oh, this is better. Why aren't we doing this? So if you're in a conservation field and you care about the environment, sometimes it's the slow and steady game that is your only choice to eventually make it happen. Look at like some of the dam removals on the West Coast, like the Elwha. I mean, people fought for that for decades before that actually happened. Now they have salmon returning to that river. They have a near shore delta sediment leaving that river that hasn't been there forever, and increases in all sorts of different things because of it. That's not unique. Every culvert removal, dam removal, restoration project has taken people working for years often to get that set up, to get it happening, to fund it, all those things. So I guess, well, they say how you eat an elephant, right? One bite at a time.
Okay, nice. Matt, do you have something that you want to share with us today?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like my quote or some words to live by is like patience is key. Whether it's dealing with certain tasks at school or just other outside life, you know, like having a lot of patience is really key and consistent, and it really does go a long way.
Oh, thank you. That was terrific. Levi?
Yes. I had it and now it's gone. Oh, yes. You know, a lot of these problems that we have in the environment, and especially in our aquatic ecosystems, and we've had a lot of discussions in classes, and I've had with, you know, employers. And a lot of the mentality is exactly what Zach was talking about earlier, is you think about, say, your Atlantic salmon, and everyone just gets stuck on the Atlantic salmon. They don't look at everything that the Atlantic salmon has to deal with in its ecosystem. And that's where I'm trying to focus a lot of my stuff is that actually is, you know, you got to look at it from an ecosystem perspective, and that's usually where the problem actually lies.
Awesome. That's terrific. And then finally, Zach, what is your favorite fish?
Well, I know what my answer probably should be, and that would be Atlantic salmon. So.
Okay, well, we'll just assume that and then let you pick another one as well. Zach, do you have one for us?
Oh, sorry. I must have cut out. I said great white shark.
All right. Okay. A little unexpected, but
we'll get. It's kind of what videos of people in cages on Discovery Channel when I was a kid is kind of what got me from the start. So that's kind of where that stems from.
Okay. Whatever it takes, I guess. Matt, do you have a favorite fish?
Yeah, so I like mahi-mahi and your average brook trout.
Okay, fair enough. Levi?
It's a little less common, but I just love the way this fish looks. And it's definitely the barrel eye. If you don't know what it looks like, you should definitely look the fish up.
Yes, everyone should look that up. That's a great place to end, Levi. That is definitely the homework that should emerge from this, other than looking into the Peter Gray Parr Project and the Downey Salmon Federation, is everyone look up the barrel eye, definitely. All right, well, thanks, everybody, and thanks for joining the Fisheries Podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me, too.